How have press freedoms in Ukraine deteriorated since the Euromaidan of 2013? Who is journalist Igor Guzva, and why is he being targeted by Ukrainian authorities? Has it become a criminal offense to express communist beliefs in Ukraine? What has happened to popular movements against the Ukraine state since the Euromaidan? Have Ukrainian critics abroad been affected by the developments of the last 3 years? On this week's Global Research News Hour, the last of our regular season, we'll be discussing how dissenting voices, particularly journalists, in post-Maidan Ukraine are being targeted by state authorities and the prospects for improvement in the face of Western media silence on the issue. Our guest for the hour is a Ukraine-Canadian scholar who has been to the country twice since the rise of Euromaidan. On this week's program, Press and Political Repression in Post-Maidan Ukraine, a conversation with Halina Mokrushina. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 30th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, Global Research. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. This wasn't the most advanced form of sarin, if there was sarin, but we really don't know. That's not the issue. The issue in my story is not to try and explain what happened, but to explain what did not happen. What did not happen is Syria did not drop a sarin bomb that morning. That was an excerpt from an interview with Seymour Hersh under the headline, Hersh, Trump ignored intel before bombing Syria, post June 28th, originally appearing at the Real News Network. U.S. President Donald Trump is playing a game of nuclear chicken with Russian President Vladimir Putin regarding Putin's threat on June 19th to go to war against the United States if the U.S. again shoots down inside Syria in the sovereign territory of the internationally recognized as legal sovereign Syrian government, Syrian aircraft, or the aircraft of any of the foreign governments that have allied with Syria, Russia, Iran, and China. After the U.S. had shot down a Syrian government plane on June 19th, which was bombing jihadists whom the U.S. government backs in order to overthrow the Syrian government, Russia announced, quote, "In areas where Russian aviation is conducting combat missions in the Syrian skies, any flying objects, including jets and unmanned aerial vehicles of the international coalition discovered west of the Euphrates River, will be followed by Russian air and ground defenses as air targets," unquote, meaning ordered out or else immediately shot down. That would place the U.S. and Russia in a traditional war against each other over Syrian territory, Russia to protect Syria's government, U.S. to replace it by a Saudi-allied jihadist one. The loser in that war over the battlefields in Syria would then have only one way to prevent defeat, which is a blitz nuclear attack against the other's homeland, World War III between Russia and U.S., which would be won, quote-unquote, by whichever of the two sides suffered the less damage, irrespective of whether the entire planet and ultimately all life will then have actually been destroyed by the exchange. That comes from the article, Trump Plays Nuclear Chicken with Putin Over Syria, by Eric Zeus, posted June 28th. Imagine how effective Woodward and Bernstein would have been in bringing down Richard Nixon had they been able to publish their Watergate investigations only in the French media. That is the situation we have reached now with Hersh's efforts to scrutinize the West's self-serving claims about Syria. As for the substance of Hersh's investigation, he finds that Trump launched 59 Tomahawk missiles at a Syrian airbase in April, quote, despite having been warned by the U.S. intelligence community that it had found no evidence that the Syrians had used a chemical weapon, unquote. In fact, Hirsch reveals that, contrary to the popular narrative, the Syrian strike on a jihadist meeting place in Khan Sheikhoun on April 4th was closely coordinated beforehand between Russian and U.S. intelligence agencies. The U.S. were well apprised of what would happen and tracked the events. That comes from the article, Hirsch's New Syria Revelations Buried from View, by Jonathan Cook, posted June 28th, originally appearing at Counterpunch. A report yesterday by the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who broke some of the biggest stories of the Vietnam and Iraq wars showed that Trump bombed Syria on April 4th based upon false pretenses. Specifically, Trump said the Syrian government carried out a chemical weapons attack on civilians, but U.S. military and intelligence officials say that they told Trump there was no evidence for that claim, and they say that what really happened is that Syria bombed Islamic terrorists, and that accidentally released chemicals being stored by the terrorists. So how does Trump respond to the report? He doubles down on the bull. That comes from the article, after getting busted for bombing Syria based on a lie, Trump doubles down, threatens to bomb Syria even harder for the same bogus reason. By Washington's blog, posted June 28th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The mainstream Western press seems unrelenting in their portrayal of Ukraine as a free society where democratic freedoms are threatened only by interference from Russia. However, critics of the Kiev government and its so-called anti-terrorism activities in the Donbass appear to be facing intimidation and repression. To share her thoughts about post-Maidan Ukraine, we're joined by Halena Mokrushina. Halena Mokrushina is currently enrolled in the PhD program in sociology at the University of Ottawa and a part-time professor. She holds a doctorate in linguistics and an MA degree in communication. Her academic interests include transitional justice, collective memory, ethnic studies, the dissent movement in Ukraine, the history of Ukraine, and sociological thought. Her doctoral project deals with the memory of Stalinist purges in Ukraine. She traveled to Lviv, Kyiv, Kharkiv and Donetsk in the summer of 2013 to conduct her field research, and she did return again in April of 2015. She joins us now from Gatineau to share her perspectives on the current state of political freedoms in the country. Halena Mokrushina, it's a pleasure to have you on our program.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
On May 14th, 2017, President Poroshenko had declared that, quote, never in its entire history had Ukraine had such an unprecedented level of freedom, in particular for journalists, unquote. The U.S.-based watchdog organization Freedom House, while acknowledging the continuation of violence, threats, intimidation, and harassment against media professionals and organizations, states that, quote, Ukraine's media environment has significantly improved since a change in government in 2014, and ongoing reforms continue to strengthen the legislative environment for journalists and outlets, unquote. It should be noted that Freedom House receives generous financial support from, among other donors, Global Affairs Canada, Google, the National Endowment for Democracy, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the U.S. Department of State, the Motion Picture Association of America, AT&T, the Walt Disney Company, Lockheed Martin, and Northrop Grumman. I asked Ms. Mokrushina to offer her comments on the changes in press freedoms since the rise of the Euromaidan.
I don't remember the exact position, but I believe Ukraine descended on it. It has one on the lower positions compared to what it was before 2013. Because, you know, we, in spite of what we hear in the West under Yanukovych, you know, the press was very critical of him. And they would allow comments and materials that, you know, now I don't see in the Ukrainian press. And, you know, there was one sociological survey of the materials on Ukrainian TV, right, critical of the current president, and the content was very low. It was like up to only 8% of the TV shows that were critical of the president. And we are talking about the mainstream Ukrainian TV, right, stations in Ukraine. So, and there are many examples of journalists being intimidated, because with the rise of this right-wing nationalists in Ukraine, the politicians have to take them into account, right? So they cannot ignore them, and they are also even not sponsored, but that they are controlled by the security service of Ukraine, right? And when we look at the trials, for instance, of journalists, and I can cite the example of Ruslan Kutsaba, it's a well-known case,
yes,
right? Or less known cases of journalist Dmitry Vasilets, who was arrested 2 years ago and is still kept in detention just because, you know, he tried to follow the basic principles of journalism, right? Covering both sides of the conflict in the Donbas. And he went to Donetsk just to, you know, to find some contacts, just to explore the possibility of covering the conflict on both sides. So upon his return to Ukraine, he was arrested and accused of, under the article that many of the political dissenters in Ukraine are detained, it's treasonry, right? A threat to national security of Ukraine, and he did nothing wrong, you know. He worked, and his colleagues are still working. It's a Channel 17 in Ukraine, and he has a blog, because there is an organization in Ukraine called Center of Freedom of Speech, and NGO, right, that is completely on a voluntary basis. And what they did, they created files of different political prisoners in Ukraine. So what I was reading this before I was, you know, I was preparing for the discussion with you. And what Dmitry Verovets, he publishes, he has a blog on this website. And essentially he writes on pieces of paper, right? And somehow he transfers these letters to his friends who are free. And in one of his letters, he was talking about how during the interrogation the security service of Ukraine offered him, in exchange of, you know, so-called confession, that they would withdraw the verdict, the serious verdict, because it's up to 10 years, right? Treason, the high treason. So they asked him to provide so-called proof that his colleagues from this channel, they were, you know, promoting separatism and terrorism, and he refused to do so. So these are, you know, serious serious statement on his behalf, and there are many other examples where. So this is one example, and then there is Yuri Apukhtin, who was very recently he was accused of again high treason and public calls to overthrow the constitutional order of Ukraine and creating mass riots, because he in the spring of 2014. He's from Kharkiv, and he's an engineer, and he was a leading researcher, and he was one of the organizers of the anti-Maidan movement in Kharkiv in the spring of in the so-called Russian spring, right, following the Euromaidan protests. And they kept him up to now in prison again, from every time prolonging this 2 months detention, and now he was accused finally of this treason and of creating mass riots, this is another example of such a case. So the political dissent, you know, in Ukraine, they are intimidated, they are arrested, they are, like I said, you know, we have these powerful right-wing so-called volunteers that they intimidate journalists, or they kill them, like the example Oleg Buzyna, and the trial again, no, it's not investigated. Those two members of the this paramilitary right wing, I can't remember the name anyway. They were arrested and then they were released.
Mm.
And we see the intimidation on behalf of these in private sector and other formations. They appear in court and they, you know, disrupt the work of the judges and they, you know, seeing this and how powerful they are, you know, judges might, some of them just prolong these pre-detention terms because they don't want any trouble, because they can come to their houses, you know, they can, and this is what they did in Odessa, so they many examples like this.
Yeah, well, I'm reading the Duran. Since January 2015, it says 11 politicians and journalists critical of the Ukraine putsch government have been mysteriously murdered, including Oles Bulizina, who you just mentioned,
yes,
as well,
mm-hmm,
as in July of 2016, Pavel Sheremet, who died in Kiev when the car he was driving blew up minutes after it was started, you know, kind of looking like something that you'd expect from the mafia. Is there a strong suspicion among not only the journalistic community, but the wider public, that the government critics are being targeted by the state?
Well, among those who among the opposition, yes, but we should not forget that, you know, these this information is not very, is not well covered in the Ukrainian media, right? So people might not, it's not exactly on the first pages of printed press or on the websites, right? And those who do, like strana.ua, they try the security service, they try to also to intimidate them and to silence them, right? And we are talking about the editor-in-chief of this internet newspaper Strana, right, .ua, who is one of the leading opposition newspapers in Ukraine. Right, and very recently he was accused of trying to bribe, blackmail a Ukrainian politician, and then they arrested him. And it's a very clear case of, you know, of the intimidation of independent journalists. And I have to admit that in spite of ideological, let's say, divergences with this internet newspaper, there are several Ukrainian journalists that actually stood up to defend him and saying that, you know, we in spite of clearly stating that they disapprove of him and of his materials, but they are they would like to defend the freedom of press. So it's not that it's you know, the political dissent is completely crushed, but it's of course there is this awareness that the freedom of speech in Ukraine is not where it should be. And it certainly does not correspond to the idealistic image that we that one gathers when one reads the Western press.
Could you give us a little bit more detail about that editor-in-chief, Igor Guzva of Strana.ua? I mean, just some background about him and these charges that are brought up, and why they just don't hold up in any fair assessment.
Well, Igor Guzva, he's the editor-in-chief, as I said, of maybe the leading opposition news, not opposition, but the internet media critical of the current Ukrainian regime in Kyiv, right? And he, before that, he worked for, he was the editor-in-chief of Sivodnya, which is still published, but he left that media outlet and he founded this one. And it right immediately became right of a prominent voice critical of the current political leaders of Ukraine. And they do journalistic investigations, right? Good quality political investigations, and all of the materials are grounded. They publish, you know, it's a good investigative journalism they conduct. And these attempts by the Security Service of Ukraine to discredit them started when Onishchenko, who was deputy and a close ally of Poroshenko, he fled to the West and he had some compromising material on Poroshenko, more specifically, for instance, how he would bribe the deputies to collect the necessary number to pass different laws, for instance, in the Ukrainian government. So this internet media outlet Strana was the only one who contacted him, the Sonishchenko, because he fled to London because he feared for his life, right? And so they started publishing these materials, and since December 2016, Guzhva said when he was arrested, there was an interview by a Russian journalist, Zakhar Vinogradov, with Guzhva, in which, and he says that we record this interview because we know that Guzhva would be arrested, because he saw it coming, right? So he says that these attempts started back in December of 2016, and he thinks that this is a retaliation, for publishing of these materials, of compromising material on Poroshenko. So essentially, he had several contacts by the people from the security service of Ukraine, and it really so they came to they really achieved it in recently in June of 2017 when they accused him of bribery. Of trying to blackmail the Ukrainian deputy from the radical party of Ljashko, and the name of this deputy is Linko, that allegedly Guzhva asked this deputy Linko to pay $20,000 in exchange of withdrawal of material, critical material and some compromising material on this deputy from the website of strana.ua. And of course, it's all there are many inconsistencies in this accusation, and it's for instance, the security service while announcing that Guzhva was arrested, and the way they arrested him, it was a breach of law, right? Because to break into the premises of a newspaper office, you have to have a
warrant.
Decision signed, the warrant, exactly, signed by the judge, and they didn't have any. Because several, maybe 10, 15 minutes before they broke in, this contact guy between Guzhva and this deputy, he brought a so-called gift. I don't know, it was a wrapped, it was a package, right? And 10, 15 minutes after this, police breaks in. One of the main proofs by the police, by the security service, was this video where Guzhva is in a restaurant talking to this contact guy, but from the dialogue it's clear that he's not asking, that the Guzhva is not the one asking for these $20,000, that this intermediary he proposes Guzhva, to blackmail the deputy anyway, and there are many inconsistencies like this. He was arrested, but with the possibility of a bail, so he was bailed out because there is this opposition party in the Ukrainian government called Opozitsyonny Blok, which is the opposition bloc. So many deputies from this bloc volunteered to bail him out from pretrial detention. So he's now back to his duties, and he says that he will continue the fight because it's a clear case of political repression for the independent position of the Strana, and then critical position towards the power.
Mm. Now, when we're talking about this kind of repression of journalists, and it sounds like a major concern is anybody who's critical of the fighting in the Donbass. But I'm wondering, just how severe it is. I mean, is there any room for you might say some of the less policy focused criticism, like the simple spoofs or caricatures that we're used to in the West of high officials, is that okay, or is there a chill even there?
No, I don't know, because there is a very popular TV show in Ukraine called the 95th District or 95th Quartal, and this is it's a satirical show, right, that makes fun of politicians, and they did not stop. They changed TV channels several times, but they are still critical of the government, and there are critical publications in Ukraine, but you know, it's moderate, right? It's very moderate. Mm-hmm. And whoever dares to see in Donbass not terrorists and separatists, the official ideology wants it, is looked upon, you know, there are several ways that you could punish such a, if we talk about the media outlets, right? You can see your license recalled. Another way of silencing or just, you know, marginalizing such a view is to, for instance, introducing quotes, right? Because the Ukrainian parliament passed this legislation according to which there has to be 75% content in Ukrainian language on TV channels, right, and 50% on radio stations. So there are ways, and then we have these, what do you call them, these vigilante, right, from the right-wing volunteers, and then there were attacks on the one of the main TV stations, Inter, in Ukraine, who have been also critical, or who covered so-called pro-Russian events in Ukraine, such as Cross March for Peace. You know, because there is this tradition in Ukraine every year that people of the Orthodox Church of Moscow Patriarchate, they march to Kyiv in the summer, right? So just to cover this procession, so it's a cross procession, not march. Even for covering such events, you know, they were criticized. Or for instance, Immortal Regiment in Kyiv and other cities in southeast Ukraine. Right, so and there were attacks on the building of this Inter TV station in Kyiv, and then, for instance, the license was recalled by the national executive body who supervises the work of all media outlets, right, and broadcasters. So that license was recalled in and I'm talking about Radio Vesti in Kyiv, right? It was as recently as in March of this year. So yes, there are examples, and people who I mentioned the 17th channel, and they actually they don't hold any so-called pro-Russian position. They try to cover again both sides of the, to be objective, right? And they are for peace in Ukraine, and they don't. But any such political or media, you know, actor, It comes under fire from these so-called patriotic volunteers, political and social activists, and they just, you know, they are marginalized. Another example is the position of Medvedchuk, who is the leader of the Ukrainian Choice, Ukrainsky Vybor, who also, you know, advocates for peace in Ukraine, and he's involved in the negotiations between Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kyiv, and thanks to him, you know, there was an exchange of prisoners between the two sides, and people who are members of his organization, they also have been attacked because they wanted to organize a conference in central Ukraine. And they were chased out of the building and called again separatists and terrorists, just because, you know, they try to bring a peaceful solution to this internal conflict in Ukraine.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. My guest is Halina Mokrushina. She's based in at the University of Ottawa, and we've been speaking about the situation of the rights and freedoms in Ukraine post-Maidan. Halina, maybe I'll just sort of expand beyond the journalistic sphere and look at some of the other dissident players. I know that there is, for example, there was a story in May of... I got this from the Norwegian blogger Pat Stegen. In May 27th, the Galicia court in Lviv recently convicted a 22-year-old communist for 2.5 years in prison because on the victory of Fascism Day on May 9th, they placed flowers on Soviet soldiers' graves and on the tombs of Ukrainian writers from the 19th century. The humanists Taras Shevchenko and Ivan Franko. So people are going to jail for their political beliefs, apparently. I don't know if you can if you would care to address that or any other similar situations where people are giving these outrageous sentences, apparently for their beliefs.
Well, I didn't hear about this case, to be honest, but I heard about a case where a student in Lviv was arrested for publishing on Facebook quotes from Lenin. Right, because now after in April of 2015, we have to go a little back in history. Right, the Ukrainian Parliament adopted a package of so-called decommunization laws. Right, and by one of these laws, the communism as an ideology was equaled with fascism and was declared illegal, right? And any symbol, any mentioning of quotes or symbols or anything that related to communism, including the symbols of Soviet flag, for instance, are considered illegal, right? And people can be not jailed but fined for using these symbols, and it's illegal under this new law. Right, but you know, it tells in itself. It tells tons about freedom of opinion in Ukraine, right? And it was condemned by Amnesty International as, you know, a great threat to the freedom of speech and freedom of opinion. And the student, you know, can you imagine a student here in Canada being arrested and accused and then tried for, I don't know, quoting Marx, for instance, on the Facebook, right? And the ridiculous part of this example is that it reminds me of Inquisition times in Spain, you know, when they would burn, God forbid, they don't burn people on those fires, but they burn books, because in verdict by this judge, they said that one of these proofs has to be destroyed, and this is the Capital by Marx, you know, one of the essential works by Karl Marx. So they considered it as a proof of the guilt of this student, and the student, he pleaded guilty in exchange for this. Confession. He was not jailed, right? Because it was a conditional liberation, he was pardoned, so to speak. So this is one example of such a case. Because as I said, under the decommunization laws, using of Soviet symbols is illegal. But, you know, what freedom of opinion are we talking about if we cannot, quote one of the texts, for God's sake? We live in the 21st century, right? Mm-hmm. And we should be free to express our opinions, our thoughts. So this is one example. And then there is another example. There are many examples, you know, of people being intimidated because, for instance, during this immortal regiment, right, we had many cases of right-wing paramilitary assaulting people who wanted just to commemorate the grandfathers or grand-grandfathers who fought in the Great Patriotic War. So there are many examples indeed, which are, to me, they are troubling because it's this whole decommunization laws are not it's a It's a threat to. It's not a threat. It's a no. It's the limiting rights of millions of Ukrainians, right? Who honor the memory of the, as I said, fathers, grandfathers, and you. For instance, this year in May of 2017, there was two rows of police, right, guarding those people who were just walking onto the streets of Kyiv to lay flowers to the monument to the unknown soldier. You know, I have never seen anything like this in Kyiv for all the independence years in Ukraine. And here you go. You know, it was very sad to see this. It's very troubling.
I'm curious to know what's happening in the academic realm, the schools, the universities. I mean, if you can't even quote Lenin, you know, I mean, what kind of expression of outrage or criticism is coming from those realms, or are there any?
Well, I believe there are. Honestly, I cannot, you know, speak in because I didn't really follow from that aspect. But from what I know, I have friends, so if I can call them Facebook friends, and they teach in Kyiv, and they have they are critical of the Kyiv government. So there is a freedom of. Certain freedom of speech. It depends, I guess, what city we are talking about and what university specifically we are talking about. But I know of a case, for instance, in Kharkiv University, and it was back 2 years ago, where the my colleague, a professor of sociology, had to step down because he was critical, and, you know, he held essentially these anti-Maidan positions, and he... The leadership, the management of the university had to fire him because one or several of his students actually filed a complaint against him. So they denounced him essentially. And then I know another example. I don't remember where it was, in Odessa or in it was somewhere in southern Ukrainian university where. They were watching a documentary about these events in Ukraine and about the so-called Russian Spring, and then one of the students, or several students, again, complained to the management of the university because there were professors who were showing this pro-separatist documentary, right? And there is another example, I cannot remember the name of that professor in Odessa, also, whose son was killed in during these tragic events on May 2nd in Odessa. And she was also ostracized by private sector in Odessa and intimidated for this anti-Maidan views. So there are cases in academic environment as well. But there are, I believe, still, I did not survey all of the universe, so I cannot talk exactly, but no. I know of cases of such, again, this denunciation and complaints by young students, because when we talk about Euromaidan, right, we are the one of the leading forces was this young generation of Ukrainians who grew up in independent Ukraine, right, who don't have such close ties to Russia, I mean, like family ties or cultural ties. So they are not, they are the products of the new independent Ukraine, right? So they don't have the same closeness to Russia.
The Western narrative is that there was so much outrage against the corruption of the Yanukovych regime. So the people rose up in peaceful demonstrations, and they, you know, were determined to bring about their, a change, and that sort of what. And of course, I mean, as we've reported on this program, I mean, there was that intrusion of all of these violent elements. So it wasn't that this pure mobilization that we're hearing about. But I am curious to know. I do believe that there were a lot, and I do believe there were a lot of people, like regular Ukrainians, who got caught up in that. You know, with legitimate concerns, I would think, about against Mr. Yanukovych. But I'm kind of wondering what happened to those people who are looking for a better Ukraine. I mean, is there no similar mobilizations or any of those similar sentiments being directed toward the current government or people, as you say, just so out of touch with the violence and the intimidation happening towards dissidents that they're oblivious to it. How do you account for the apparent lack of a reverse Maidan within Kiev and other parts of Ukraine?
Well, you know, I'm a cynicist in that regard, and I believe that any social movement, it cannot last, right? Unless you have some regular basis underneath it, meaning some financial support, right? And we should not forget that this Euromaidan, yes, there were masses of ordinary Ukrainians who rose against the corruption, but, you know, I don't think it was so much against the corruption as it was against this dream that has been promoted for all these years, you know, about this European paradise. Because when we talk about this this idea of many Ukrainians, that to me, you know, I realized after reading a lot that it was to a certain extent this dream about the lost Soviet paradise, you know, dream about that by joining the European Union, all this misery, all these problems will be solved because somebody will solve them for Ukraine. No, so that it was this huge dream that Ukrainians saw being taken away from them, you know, by this decision or by Yanukovych. He did not refuse. You know, we often hear that he refused to sign. He just asked for a delay, right? He postponed the signing of the agreement because Yanukovych has never been pro-Russian in the sense of political orientation, right? He continued the Ukraine's course towards the European Union. But he just realized in the last minute, not in the last minute, but let's say almost in the last minute, that this association with the European Union would hurt Ukraine economically a lot. And this is what we see happening now. And he was right. But the problem of the Party of Reason was that they did not pay enough attention to ideology. No, because when we are talking about a social upheaval, right, you need an ideology to mobilize people. Right? And the Party of Regions, I read an interview with Mykola Azarov, who is the former prime minister of Ukraine, and he said that one of our biggest mistakes was that we did not pay enough attention to ideology. That they thought that, you know, if they create more or less decent life for masses of people, that would be enough. But it's not enough. You know, and of course, people are now very disappointed. If we look at sociological surveys, the numbers are disastrous for the current political leadership, because the level of trust is very low towards any kind of power, whether we talk about the parliament, or the judiciary, or the police, especially towards Poroshenko. You know, his level of support dropped below 5%, so it's even lower than Yanukovych had. And we see over 80% of Ukrainians are disappointed with the current situation and think that Ukraine is not going in the right direction and that things are not getting better, they are getting worse and worse. So there is this disappointment that was there also after the first Orange Maidan, right, in 2004. But to have this Maidan, you know, you have to have financial support, right? And financial support comes where? It comes from politicians who are in opposition to the current government, right? And there are none. Mm. So without this financial support from oligarchs, right, because this Maidan was supported to a large extent by Ukrainian oligarchs who were unhappy with Yanukovych, because Yanukovych's attempt to bring under his control and his family control of resources in Ukraine, right? So this was one of the elements of that Maidan. But if you look at, again, I don't remember the exact numbers, but Ukraine descended even more in terms of corruption, because according to Transparency International, Ukraine, you know, this country, in the second 100 of countries who are the most corrupted, right? And these indicators did not improve, meaning that Ukraine, you know, lowered even more its position on this rating of corrupted countries. So if you look at these indicators that were before Euromaidan and after Euromaidan, nothing improved really. So it's the of course disappointment is there, but and discontent is there, but there is no political force that would step in and mobilize, right? So I don't think we'll see a second or a third Maidan, because if we look at the protests in Ukraine, right, there were many protests essentially by workers, by academics, by scientists, by workers, but they don't move anywhere because there is no unifying political force that would bring those people together and really create a massive movement. So unfortunately, I don't see anything in the near future.
Halina Mokryshina, who's you're an academic based at the University of Ottawa, PhD candidate. You are part of the Ukrainian diaspora.
Well, I used to be.
Oh, used to be.
I'm not anymore.
Yeah. Are you comfortable? I'm just because it seems like there's a lot of intense support for the Ukraine government within Canada and within the Ukrainian diaspora. And somebody who used to be part of that, I'm wondering. How if you could possibly comment on maybe some of the challenges of engaging people in your longtime friends and neighbors on this topic and just trying to
I don't know, Michael. You touched a very very
difficult one.
Well, I can talk about it because actually thank you for asking that question because it's a very personal question, right? Because I was involved, I was part of this diaspora and I still love it for its engagement in Ukraine, for its genuine desire, to see the life of Ukrainians improved. But when I started following these events on Euromaidan and I saw where it was going, I said that you are doing, you cannot just support one side and you ignore this pro-Russian Ukraine, right? It will I felt like Cassandra. It's not a very pleasant feeling, but this is how I felt when I I remember it was, I believe, in mid-February when I sent out an email to my colleagues from the Ukrainian National Federation here in Ottawa, saying that there is this violent element within Maidan, Euromaidan movement, and violence breeds only violence. But it has fallen on deaf ears because it's all about democracy, right? About this very naive, not to say stupid, mythology about popular revolution. It's only part of the truth, right? But we should not forget that the active the nucleus of the Ukrainian diaspora, active Ukrainian diaspora here, are children and grandchildren of Western Ukrainians, right? Who came to Canada after the Second World War, and then their parents were deported by Soviets to Siberia. They were killed. So they have this very negative, very memory about the Soviet Ukraine, and they are nationalistic, right? And they are followers. Among them are followers of Bandera and Shukhevich, who are now venerated in Ukraine as national heroes, but who are murderers, right?
Nazi collaborators. Yeah.
Exactly. And I did not realize that, you see, because for me it was in the distant past, but past never passes, as one of the French historians said. And then that memory comes back very powerfully, and they just, they hate Russia so much and pro-Russian Ukraine so much, it blinds them. They don't see, because we talk about the Soviet Ukraine, right? And I'm part of that Soviet Ukraine, and it's a mixed bag, right? There were bad things, there was famine, there were repressions, but there were also bright sides, right? There was this social security, there was free medicine, there were many good things in that society. But these leaders of the Ukrainian diaspora, they refuse to see it, right? They don't see it. So it's very difficult. I don't know. I still have to. I had to step down because I realized that any new discussion with my colleagues would turn out in a fight in a and I just stepped down. And since then I started writing because for me it was a way of saying what I think about the because I deeply care about Ukraine. I care also in the same way as the Ukrainian diaspora does. But I'm a political, I guess, dissident myself.
So feel like a lone voice, eh?
Exactly. Well, I would really love to find other Ukrainians who think like me. I found some in Ukraine, but I don't know a lot of Ukrainians here in Canada who think like I do, and that's the big problem because Ukrainian Canadians are a powerful voice in Canada. And they, like I said, I admire them for their love for Ukraine and for their determination and all. But they made a series of mistakes, I believe, and now we are unfortunately in an irreparable situation. And we see this worsening of relations with Russia. I don't have any optimistic outlook in the near future. I don't know. I just maybe at some point this love for my country of origin will become. I'll find a way, but for the time being, I just keep. I just stand by myself, and I don't know where it will lead me. We will see. But it's a very difficult situation because after that trip to Ukraine in April of 2015. With my colleague, what they did, I don't know if it was the security service of Ukraine or people who are close to those circles, they broke the correspondence with the people from the Donetsk People Republic, right? And there is this horrible website called Peacemaker. I don't know if you heard about this website.
No.
No, but it's essentially a website where they publish personal data of people, of journalists. There was a huge scandal last year when they published the databases of all foreign journalists who worked at some point in Donetsk, over 5,000 names. And there was a big scandal because, and this website is sponsored by the Security Service of Ukraine. And the official sponsor of this website is the Chancellor of the Ministry of the Minister of Interior of Ukraine, the Herashchenko. So they published, made public. It's an open access. The phone numbers, names of all foreign journalists who at some point worked in Donetsk, including leading mainstream Western media. So the OSCE reacted and the Council of Europe reacted, asking to close this website. They closed it temporarily for several days, and then they reopened it because it's some kind of a vigilante website where they publish names of all people, not only journalists, who are critical or who hold the separatist or terrorist views and who so this website, it's a scandal, right, because it breaches the law on privacy, and any Western country in existence of such a website would be unthinkable. So what they did, these guys, they broke the correspondence of I believe she was called at that moment the Minister of Information or something, and they got hold of our passports, of myself and my colleague from Vancouver, Roger Annis. You interviewed him.
Mm-hmm.
So now our passports are in open access on the internet. The copies of the first two main pages of the passports, with name, with date of birth, and the passport number, right? And they are accusing us of, I'm accused of, crossing illegally the border because we went to Donetsk through the Russian border. It is illegal indeed, but it's and they accuse me of manipulating the socially important information.
My goodness.
No, just because I went to the, and because I interpret these events in Kyiv differently. You know, it doesn't help neither. And I contacted my MP office, but they didn't know what to do with me. Because they didn't come across such a situation. So I tried to, you know, I contacted them, and then I said, you know what, I'll just drop this whole issue altogether, because I really, and now I cannot go back home. No, to Ukraine, because I don't know, I might be arrested when I cross the border. Because one of our colleagues who wanted, there were several tours, right? Five tours, I believe. And it was organized by a Russian, German NGO. And one of the colleagues who went with us on that tour, he warned us. He said, you know, I would disadvise you to travel to Ukraine. You should keep away from Ukraine. And, you know, can you imagine, my whole family is in Ukraine. I mean, I have only my immediate family here, but all of the rest is in Ukraine. And now I cannot, I do not dare going there, because I don't know. You know, when I see all these stories of political dissenters being jailed, I don't know what to expect. So to me, it says a lot about freedom of speech in Ukraine. You know?
Yeah, well, I think that personal anecdote really says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So there is nothing more to add, you know, about... I wish, and it hurts, of course, because I was the only Ukrainian, you know, who went on that trip. I went on that trip because I cared, you know, I really, and it was a difficult trip for me. Because I saw, you know, I could never imagine that a war would break up in Ukraine. But then, you know, why Ukraine would be different from other countries where we see civil war and people killing each other. So it's a very,
This is
where we are.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very tragic situation. And
It is, and I don't see any, yes. So, to answer your question, if I will reconcile with the Ukrainian diaspora, the one venue that I would work with them, it would be on the reconciliation. You know, that I would really, I would happily participate in any such effort, but I don't know. I might as I might not, but because I don't see any change of position within the Ukrainian diaspora. So it's we'll see what the future brings. You know, who knows? Maybe these forces within Ukraine will mobilize. I doubt it, but at least I still have hope, because there are many Ukrainians, you know, within Ukraine who are working on who see what's happening and who. Try to do something to bring this country back to peace.
Well, Halina Mokrushina, I want to thank you very much for being so generous with your time, and wish you well going forward, and look forward to reading more of your articles on the newcoldwar.org and other sites.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you for having me and for listening to all I had to say. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. We've been speaking with Halina Mokrushina. She's a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Ottawa and part-time professor, and she joined us from Gatineau. You can find more of Halina Mokrushina's writing on the website newcoldwar.org. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. The Global Research News Hour will be on hiatus for the summer break. For the next few weeks, we will supply special programming for CKUW and our various affiliates, as well as to the site globalresearch.ca. Our regular season will resume in September. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Thank you for listening.